Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good evening, and welcome to the North Oakland Speaker Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Gabby, and I'm an alcoholic and tonight's secretary. Please,
Hi.
Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones, and please help me open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. This is a speaker meeting. I'm going to speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, who is Lee, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. So I'm Gabby. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm really grateful to be an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be an AA. I guess my whole life, I think I was born an alcoholic. Like, I don't really know exactly what that means, but the darkness that I really associate with being in the addiction, I feel was there all since I was all through my childhood. And when I was 14, I drank and I found what I'd been looking for. And from the first time I drank, I blacked out and threw up and passed out. And I grew up in a really, I didn't have a nice home life, and I really felt like that was a prison for me. And when I was 17, I started really drinking heavily, and it kind of took me out of that in a way, or I felt like it was sheltering me from that. I could deal better with it. But in a way, I was just, before I could turn 18 and move out, I just basically stepped from one jail to another. And then I spent the next 7 years drinking and going through my own personal hell. And when I was 18, I had been drinking heavily for like a year, and I came to AA for the first time, and I thought that it was going to teach me how to drink, you know, socially or whatever. I don't know what I thought. And I didn't want to drink like any other way than when I was drinking, and I went back, and for years I just drank like crazy. I'm sure you can all relate. And the last time that I really tried to stop drinking, and I kind of had this idea that I would change my life, I failed again. I went to AA, but I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps, and inevitably started drinking again. And I had this idea come into my head that there may be, because I did have an idea of spirituality throughout my whole life, but I had an idea that there may be a God, but he didn't favor me, you know. I realized for the first time that there was nothing special about me. And I was an alcoholic, and I knew I was an alcoholic, and I couldn't control my alcohol, and that I was going to die an alcoholic, because that's how it works. And that is still true, but we'll get to that. That thinking really enabled me to hit my bottom. Like, I completely stopped trying to take care of anything or do anything, and I was very no morals, and I was like, even if there's a good, if there's a God, he's not good or bad, he just is, and this is my life, and I'm absolutely powerless to stop drinking. I cannot stop drinking. I've tried. There's no way that I can stop drinking. And I had a friend of a friend died. He hung himself. He was an alcoholic, and he hung himself. And throughout my life, I've had several experiences where I've had conversations with my disease, and I don't really know how to explain that, but I've had very real conversations with it, and it was also like my best friend. Like I felt like alcohol was my reason to live. And when he killed himself, I realized that my best friend was a murderer and was trying to kill me. And I know that sounds really dramatic, but this is, you know, I was really fucked up at the time. This is what was going through my head. And I was like, I can't drink anymore. And I feel like at this point, this is like where all of my ideas stopped and something else took over. And I came to AA and I sat around for like 2 months and I didn't do anything. And then I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. And for about a year, I really don't know how I didn't drink again, because I was trying my hardest not to change my life. I was living with somebody who was drinking all the time, and I was still going to bars, and I was trying really hard to keep everything the same, and I was in a lot of pain. I would cry hysterically all the time, and I was like, if this, because I drank for 7 years, so I'm like, in 7 years, if it's still like this, I'm going to kill myself. Like, this is not working. And when that time comes, if I've heard, you know, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, so I took the first step and I came to AA. I wanted to believe, I'd heard that the steps worked for people, so I had come to believe in a power greater myself, which was AA, and that I thought that I could be restored to sanity. And I was like, and if it doesn't work at 7 years, this is done. I have 2 years now. My sobriety date is February 9th, 2008. After about 1 year, I started working the steps, and in a way, like through that experience with me coming in as a result of me seeing somebody die, I think about his mother, and his mother, you know, just must be heartbroken and devastated. But out of that, like I saw something, and this tragic situation, there's two sides of the situation, and things happen that I might not understand, but I don't know how far the effects are. And that allowed a little bit into my mind that maybe turning my will over to whatever is controlling, to a higher power that is has its hands on everything, might not be such a stupid idea, or might be the key, since that was what I kept on hearing over and over again. And I'm going through kind of a difficult time right now, or I'm going through a really dramatic, like a transformative time right now, and it's because of characteristics that I have and character defects that I have that I've been operating with my entire life. And had I still been drinking, if I were still drinking now, I'd still be operating with them, and I may or may not be alive, but I feel so grateful that I have the opportunity to face these head on. And I would always I always really doubted that it would work, but by thoroughly working each step when I was at it, I've really been able to get to the next one like with a whole heart. And it's been really, really, really amazing. And miraculously through this, I've gained some self-esteem, and I've always really hated myself and thus hated everybody around me. And today, like I said, as a result of working the steps and finding a higher power, like I find more of a place for myself in this world, and I feel like I have a place in the world, and it doesn't have to be miserable. And whether I may deem it good or bad, like as long as I'm doing the right thing. I can't think of another way to put it, but as long as I'm doing what I'm doing with a clear conscience and a clear head, then I'm on the right path. And I am just really grateful to be here, and I'm really grateful that you're all here, because if it wasn't for all you, I wouldn't be able to be sober, so thank you very much. Turn it over to Lee, who's our speaker.
I am Lee. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lee.
And this is not at all what I was expecting. Luke asked if I would speak at this meeting, and he called it a pretentious meeting. I'm thinking Rock Ridge, pretentious. I'm thinking white guys and Volvos. I wasn't thinking fixed speed bicycles and beanie caps, pretentious. So I took my one jacket and I took it to the dry cleaners last week. Picked it up a couple of days later, actually paid for it, picked it up. My one white shirt I got, I washed it. It's kind of white. I put some bleach in it. I said, oh, fuck, I got to iron it. So I used to iron every Super Bowl. That was, we would iron. So it's true, tight. You have all your friends over on the Super Bowl. They bring an iron and, you know, their liquor, and they're ironing. We do it once a year, so I don't iron too well. So tonight I get out of the shower, and I get my white shirt out, and I'm looking for something to iron on, and I pick this little, like, TV dinner tray thing I kept behind the couch. I don't eat TV dinners, but they call that the tray. And I get it out, and I put a towel over it, and the towel's slipping, so I put a rubber band on it. One of the legs breaks off. So I'm sitting here naked with the iron and the shirt the size of a fucking tent over a three-legged thing, trying to hold one leg up in iron. Going, you know, this fucking pretentious meeting, I've got to go through all this. So I get the shirt on, get in the car, pick up a friend. I'm driving here. I'm going backwards, you know, pulling out of my driveway. I think, what's this shit in the back? Somebody left some clothes wadded up in a bag here. Oh, shit, what's this? Is it trash? I pull up. It was this jacket I had stuffed over the last few days. I had stuffed down in like a fucking ball behind the seat. And I get here, and it's the other pretentious. And frankly, I'm relieved. I was not a white wine and brie kind of crackhead. I was. Before I try and get cute or get this side of the room sober and that shit, I want to talk about something that's actually most important to me, which is the gift Alcoholics Anonymous has granted to me. Nothing I did or didn't do or that I know or that I don't know put me in a position to be sober, to stand here, my turn to share my story. I simply, for some reason, God, in an act of grace, said, Lee, it's your turn. Bro, you've suffered enough. It's your turn to be able to hear, to be able to listen, to be able to work the steps. For some reason, God said, your number's up. I was able to hear and listen, to work the steps, and to be relieved of the obsession, be made useful to God and my fellows. It's a fucking amazing life. And if I say nothing else, I could sit down now. That sums it up. But most of my story is a drunkalogue or a drugalogue or an agonyalogue, you know, put it some other way. You know, I do dwell on how long I used, how much I relapsed, how bad it was, because I didn't come from a high bottom. You know, she just spoke about drinking for 7 years and having alcoholism talk to her. I call it the talking tumor. You know, it talks. They're called sponsees. They go, you know, no, I think I really, I'm never going to drink again. I don't need meetings. They go, oh, okay. So I drank for 37 years, actually through 5 decades. You know, when people say they qualify, I don't really want to qualify for how long I drank or how many laptops I stole. I want to qualify that I realized I had an obsession of the mind, an allergy of the body. Nothing between my ears is going to fix the problem. Nothing between your ears is going to fix the problem. And my qualification is I worked the steps, had a spiritual awakening, and fuck his life better. To me, that's qualifying. So, I got a long Duke Fightmaster. You guys remember Duke? Some of you folks. He used to call this surfing the long wave. These long shares. So we're gonna surf the long wave here. My daughter just had a baby. I'm a grandfather. I put a lot into it. they're calling me Gramps. Gramps. I said, okay, dude, check yourself here. I'll answer to Graham or half Graham, but not to Gramps. So she's having this really shitty labor, and we're there in the hospital for who knows how long. We're all in the same clothes for a couple days. We're all just zombies. The baby's born, and like an hour later, you know, her two sisters have 3 daughters. There's my 3 daughters, one with a baby, their mom. We're sitting there. It's fucking idyllic. It's wonderful. Totally wonderful. And the baby is this little squishy thing that's been extruded out, these big eyes. And she puts the baby to her breast, and the thing kind of sniffs around. Its eyes opens up, and it sees this breast, and it kind of sniffs around and latches onto it. and starts boop, 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 just wailing on it. Fuck. Like, hammers it for a long time there. It rolls back, its eyes roll back, like milk's coming out, it's like out. Wakes up again, right back to the tit. And I said, the first time I drank, I understood that. I understand it completely. If you've ever done crack, you know that feeling. So I called my daughter the next day in the hospital. I said, you know that thing, the way your child took to the breast? I said, that's how it is for an alcoholic. She goes, oh, Dad, I get it. It was kind of like moonshine or boobshine. Yeah, yeah. She calls me like 2 days later. Goes, Dad, she's got blisters on her lips. The kid's sucking so hard now, there's blisters on her lips. So if you've ever done crack, you know what I'm talking about. No? Oh yeah, alcoholism. When I stand up here, it's always stressful. Speaking at any meeting, it's always stressful. Am I going to get enough, you know, cool points, or am I going to fuck up or what? But anytime you sit up here and the meeting begins, there's a beautiful cadence to the beginning of every meeting. There's the readings, and your mind begins to calm down a little. And then there's the introductions of everybody saying, hi, Frank. Hi, Jenny. That's an amazing cadence that my soul loves. We could have done this a whole hour. I would have loved it. You're just one person at a time speaks, and we all say hello. So there's a wonderful cadence. One person reads, and we listen. One person says they're new, and we listen. Outside, I have like 10 voices in my head. I come in here, and there's only one voice at a time. So by the end of everyone saying hello at the first beginning of a meeting, I'm kind of calmed down from simply sitting here with other alcoholics, communing that we have a solution. One of us talks at a time. Some of you may wish you could talk instead of me, but that's how it works. I cannot point to a long legacy of alcoholics in my family. I come from a long history of... I can't say that. I was raised by Mormons, and I can claim that with equal, you know, equal agony that I was raised by Mormons. You know, all my relatives on both sides are LDS, and it's a rather quirky thing. But I was in agony from my earliest memories. I was in agony. You ever heard the term critical thinking? Yeah, I'm really good at critical thinking, but not in the way I think they meant. Like, everything hurts. I'm painfully self-aware. Like, everything that I engage hurts. It's true. It's true. So my earliest thoughts were, I suck. I can smell me, kind of thing. Like, I was hoping I could fool people into liking me. My dad was 6'5", about 360 pounds, this weird Republican guy, and I was really overweight. You're going to be just like your dad. This is great. Yeah, this is great. So, like in those, like the movie Goonies, whatever, there's a really fat kid. There's like one in every ensemble, there's the fat kid who they punch. That was me. And it sucked, but I would prefer to be punched by my friends than to be alone. That was my existence. So at age 13, when I discovered pot, it was a wonderful act of grace. The discovery of drugs and alcohol was not some beginning of a problem in my life. It was a beginning of a solution in my life. I knew ease and comfort, which I did not know prior. I knew how to think. I was really good at thinking. In fact, I'd wake up and my mind already had a whole agenda of things to discuss before I got out of bed. I was good at thinking. My thoughts cannot make me comfortable. It's impossible. It'll sure try. It's the hardest working band in show business. My thoughts cannot make me comfortable. They can identify a solution. If this happens, we'll be okay. If that son of a bitch hadn't done this, I would be okay. Or if we get that, I will be okay. My thoughts are incapable of calming me, of giving me a sense of peace, harmony, or connectedness to God. My thoughts make me uncomfortable. So by age 13, thinking nonstop from 0 to 13, I deserved drugs. And I got both feet in the trough. I started smoking pot at 13, and it was on. The very next thing I started doing was dealing drugs, because you're better than others. If you're dealing drugs, you're far better than the man next to you. So I did that. My parents didn't like it too much, but fuck them. So I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. When I was 19, just almost ready to turn 20, I was addicted to heroin. And my heroin dealer friend said, Lee, you know, we're a little trouble here in Phoenix. The heroin was very good in 1972. It was very good heroin for very cheap in Phoenix. He's a Mexican with an endless supply. And he goes, Lee, we got to get out of Dodge. We're going to die here. I go, good idea. So we pack our cars. I packed one set of clothes in my stereo. He packs a lamp. And sort of got a lamp and a couple things. And we decide to move to San Francisco because San Francisco won't have heroin. That was our conclusion. And in a sense, he was right, in a sense. We drove to, like, 2 in the morning. We come down Van Ness, and just like, you know, car dealerships and nothing. I go, fuck, San Francisco's a, what the fuck is this? And I'm thinking Barbary Coast, and it's like, you know, Don Ellis Chevrolet and, you know, Kinko's. My friend runs to the gas station, and a few minutes later, come on, I follow him in his car, we go to the Tenderloin. And we get like a by-the-week hotel in the Tenderloin. And that's right back where I started. So from 1973 till now, I've lived in San Francisco with alcoholism. And like a year later, I was sleeping on the floor of a rock band called The Tubes. They lived out in the Avenues. 46th and Noriega was their rehearsal facility. I was sleeping on the floor there. Their roadie got like a pound of coke or something and disappeared. He had pressing corporate issues, so he went off somewhere else. They woke me up and said, Lee, you're our new roadie. Okay. I didn't know anything about it, but it's a job. So for 8 years, I worked for that band called The Tubes here in San Francisco. It wasn't a very sober environment. Their big song was called White Punks on Dope. And it was really, you know, I had arrived, as Bill said in his story, I had arrived. I had prestige and I had drugs. I didn't have money and prestige, but I had drugs and prestige, which was interchangeable. For 8 years, I worked for this band, and I was clueless as to what life was about, what I was about, or what was happening. I went around the world on 5 world tours, albums, accolades, bullshit, ODs here and there. Clueless of what was really happening. My alcoholism was progressing. I didn't understand it, but it understood me. So 1973 or 74, I started working for the band. In 1979, my wife, who was one of the dancers, got pregnant. And she explained that, you know, honey, I won't have a heroin addict in the delivery room. So you need to take care of your heroin problem, or I'm getting a new birth coach and a new dad. So I tried to go get sober. I went to my first rehab in 1979. I went to a rehab with a suitcase. While they're waiting to check me in, I had a moment of clarity that this is a scam to get my money. I dragged my suitcase back to the car, drove home, and I said to my wife, they said, your problem isn't that bad. Go home and be a good father. I tried. My attempts got the family into bankruptcy. I went on a, well, called an internal vacation. I got a $20,000 line of credit from some bank or something, and like through that summer, did 20 grand in drugs, and just, you know, one guy's pager number seemed, you know, 20 grand to one pager kind of thing. So I put the family in bankruptcy. I really hadn't told her that I was on drugs again. She comes down one day, and I'm doing heroin on the washing machine down on the downstairs. And I look up, and she's staring at me. She goes, oh, this explains a lot. The bankruptcy. I go, yeah. She goes, the mystery illness you've had where you can't work. I go, yeah. She goes, well, you know, you need to get out of here. You need to leave. So she threw me out. Best thing that ever happened to either of us. And I went to another rehab here in Oakland called MPI. So that's a few blocks from here. Went to MPI, which was ranked number 2 in the nation. I thought, okay, a man of my stature, I'm going there. I couldn't get into Betty Ford, right away, so I'd settle for number two. And it's my experience that they can treat athlete's foot and those things, they cannot treat alcoholism. But I went for 28 days. My favorite thing that I say is I wrote a goodbye letter to my drug of choice, which I really did with, full heart. They said that you had to take the third step. So we were all assigned to go back to our rooms and take the third step and come back that afternoon surrendered. So I was rooming with two other guys. One was a preacher from the Love Center, this African-American guy, his name was Reverend Al, fantastic guy, 50 years old, crackhead, and just a fantastically spiritual guy. And this other guy was like a professor, and they're totally serene, and they're surrendered. And I'm going and looking in the bathroom in my face, what would a surrendered guy look like? So I'm kind of come up with a face that would tell him. So I'd come out and I'd show him a face, and I go, am I surrendered? They go, no, dude, no. I thought that's how the steps worked. You picked a face in the mirror that looked surrendered, and somehow, you were there. 28 days later, people said so many nice things about me. They just testified how wonderful I was and how we were going to be friends for life, and had an NA book with 1,000 numbers and names in it. I got this huge coin I could barely lift, that I'd graduated, I was cured, and I went home. Not they wouldn't go to my kid's house, no, I was kicked out of there. But within a week, I was relapsed again. So, day 35 from trying to get sober, I was on dope again. Now, even if I wasn't on dope, it was going to be bad. I had taken vodka and heroin out of my system, and they were my solution. I had not replaced it with any spiritual solution. I did not replace it with the steps or with God. I simply took my solution from being painfully self-absorbed and claimed to be cured of that, and left there more self-absorbed and painful than ever without relief at hand. It lasted 7 days. So I hate me anyhow without being a heroin addict. So I suck. I have since I'm a kid. Now I suck and I'm a heroin addict. No one must know. I suck and I'm a heroin addict. My boss and my wife think I'm recovered, but I'm using again. So there's all these things starting to build up. Oh, and I'm stealing a computer a day from work to pay for my heroin because her lawyer took all my money. That was my daily existence. So many layers of pressure that I'm walking around saying, recovery doesn't work. That was my, my belief. It just went downhill from there. So I could give you wash, rinse, repeat. I did that for probably 4 or 5 years through two jobs. I was a vice president at a Fortune 100 company in San Francisco. I had a quarter office, top floor bullshit, could fly around the world, blah, blah, blah. When you're a drug dealer most of your life, and toured in the rock band for 8 years and go into the business world, they're moving at half speed. They're going, well, what do you mean? You say, motherfucker, you're lying. Get real, you're lying. And they say, how did you know he was lying? It's just people like you and I, we... People in this room know that stuff or would be dead. We're the things that would not die in here. We're that because we can tell when someone's lying. We can tell when something isn't right. That's how we lived this long. Because what we've been doing would have been dead. So I really excelled in the business world. Kind of like oat bran, it really brought out some weird stuff there. So... I got called from my manager, and he said, you need to come, come to the big VP's office. I go, oh, fuck. I go in there. His table is completely empty, his desk, except for all these papers lined up symmetrically. Each one is where I had charged from Bank of America. I had charged a cash advance on the company's Visa card. They get the bill. $200 a day cash advance over and over and over and over. And I walk in, I just say, okay, I want to apologize for humiliating all of you. I want to thank you for the opportunity of working here. I'll clean out my desk. And the big VP goes, sit down. He goes, how do you explain this? And I go, I offer no explanation. I'm sorry I've let you down. And my boss is in tears. And so the big boss goes, you know, Lee, you're the best guy we have here, but you're bumping your head a lot. You seem to bump your head on. You got something going on with you. And he takes the Visa card out of his pocket, and he plucks it down on the table in front of me, and he goes, we're going to keep you around for a while and just see where this goes. My boss grabs the Visa card and puts it in his suit coat, and the big VP goes, oh no, hand him the card back. This is going to be fun to watch. Now, they talk about the insanity of alcoholism. Completely sober, completely abstinent, with no drugs or alcohol in my body. The next day, I took that Visa card across the street from where I just got in trouble to the bank and got a $200 cash advance. Completely sober, completely abstinent. The insanity of alcoholism that I've been restored to was not the zany shit in a tutu, you know, in the middle of the night. The insanity of alcoholism is the notion, I must do this above all else. I must go get this money and buy heroin more than I must breathe. To me, that's the insanity of alcoholism. Guess what? They caught on to me. Two or three days later, I get this call from my boss. Come upstairs, man. What the fuck did you do? So I go upstairs to the top floor, and my boss goes, just sign your name here. I quit. And run. He goes, if you ever anyone asks, I'll say you resigned. He goes, they're going to get the police. Run. So I run down the stairwell, 22 flights, screaming, ah! Out onto Market Street, I'm running down 11th, I'm pumping my fist in the air, fuck the man, fuck the man! Like this Rocky shit, and I realized what was so exciting to me was I could finally drink and drug the way that I needed to. Now nothing stood between me and round-the-clock drinking and drugging. I didn't have to go and pretend to even show up at work. I had a fucking retirement plan I could cash in. So I got another job. This other guy at a startup company did not know that I was Godzilla. He thought I was a VP at the bank. And he hired me at his .com startup, and it went through the roof with money. All of a sudden, I was a millionaire. So now I'm a crackhead, alcoholic, soulless liar with a bunch of money in the bank. I had arrived. But oddly enough, my alcoholism had said, dude, we're, you know, yeah, we can do this. So I'm starting to get really sick at work. I come like around 11, I come into work and they go, oh, we didn't really understand that email you sent at 4 o'clock last night. Well, I didn't send an email. I go, oh, yeah, you did. You know, I check, it's like something like this long. I started drinking so much I went into kidney failure. And I turned about the color of this tablecloth. I was green. I couldn't fit into my own shoes. When your kidneys quit, you can't shunt toxins out of your body. I began to balloon up in this green color and start to inflate. They go, man, did you get beat up or what? So I'm starting to balloon up. I don't stop drinking. My new boss at the new job says, Lee, I need to talk to you. She takes me in. Lee, what's going on? I said, I have a kidney problem. It was this black lady, Roz Pennington, who just moved here from LA, and she goes, check it out, bro. My husband's got a kidney problem, too. You need to get your ass to the 28-day program, get your kidney taken care of. Get the fuck out of here. I didn't go into a 28-day, I didn't go to another one. I'd already gone through one there. I'd gone there to put me through one rehab at that job. I just walked out of there knowing I was haunted. Nothing could cure me. I was fucked. I was just going to go home and hold on to the rest of my stock money till I died. Well, spending as much as I could on crack and vodka till I died. Whenever you hear crack mentioned in a share of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can be sure that nudity and the 12 steps are coming right after that. And that was my experience. I'm very grateful for crack cocaine. It fast-tracked me to the position of something's wrong here. And in 2001, which is my sobriety, got sober in 2001, I was like laying naked in the fetal position, like hovering, burrowing in trash like a hamster trying to stay warm. And that was what I was down to. People talk about blackouts, coming up out of a blackout. I've done that, not knowing where I was, with guys trying to take my cowboy boots off and screw me kind of thing. I've done that. But waking, coming out of a blackout, not knowing who you are, is far more puzzling. So I would come out of these psychotic breaks not knowing who I was. And that was starting to bother me. So I was uninsurable, had no money, hadn't paid my rent in God knows how long to my crack house. I called the Salvation Army. They said, yeah, come on down, we'll take you. So I jumped on the number, put all my stuff in a, you know, they call it the dope fiend luggage, I think it's a silly fucking term, but I put my stuff in a trash bag and I sneak on the number 33 bus. I don't even have bus, you know, disabled bus fare. I get there, I flunk the breathalyzer. They didn't mention that you have to pass the breathalyzer, so they send me home. I stay up all night, don't drink, go back the next day, I pass the breathalyzer. Welcome to Salvation Army. Now bear in mind, through all this, I had sold anything in my apartment that I could possibly sell for crack. The rest of my furniture I'd chopped into pieces because it did not obey me. And if you've ever been, you know, in a psychotic break on speed or crack, you know what I'd build these tents with my furniture to hide, kind of hamsterish. And then they would collapse on me. I'd get in a rage and I turned it into mulch. My apartment was like 2 feet deep. 2 feet deep in mulch was my apartment. Of vodka bottles, like porn tapes, broken this and that. So, you know, I was ready for 30 days at the Salvation Army. I was going to, you know, put on a little weight, maybe use some toilet paper, put my resume together, and get back out there and get to work. So I go back the next day, I pass a breathalyzer, and I'm blind without my glasses. I'm blind. So by this point, I've sold everything in the apartment. I have one piece of one lens. I walk around like a monocle, looking at everything. And if any of you have ever seen a crackhead, he's only looking for one thing all the time. So I'm walking around everywhere because I know there's an elusive crack rock here. So everywhere you go. And that's how I checked into Salvation Army in 2001. And I walked in the door. My intention was to maybe eat, to maybe take a shower. You know, my intention was not to do the 12 steps. My intention was not to have a relationship with God. My intention was not to have a psychic change. That shit didn't work. But in 2001 at the Salvation Army, a whole new life started for me. People at the Salvation Army, not Harbor Light, that's like graduate school. This is called the ARC on Cesar Chavez in Valencia. It's clothing wars there. All the beneficiaries are picking out the nicest outfits. There's 18 trucks a day of donations that come through there. 18 deliveries a day of stuff. So all the dudes all day long are like, you know, picking out new outfits and, you know, mix and matching for the ultimate outfits. After 30 days, you're allowed to leave. You're allowed to leave the premises. So like a whole gang of us that are now able to leave, and we're going out. We're going to a place called Home Group, which is pretty much this in San Francisco. You know, so this is like Home Group East kind of thing. So we all get decked out, like this whole, you know, raiding party of us come from the Salvation Army down to Home Group and walk in the door. And it was much like this meeting, very similar to this meeting. A lot of laughter, a lot of clarity in people's eyes, a solution and a happiness you could sense that was palpable. It wasn't some dreary fucking, you know, AA meeting like they had at Salvation Army where it's like you want to poke a pencil in your eye kind of thing. This was, you walk in there. You know what I'm talking about. It's like, fuck yeah, these people are happy. Now, you're supposed to go, welcome home. You know, they're supposed to say, welcome home, you're the newcomer, welcome. You never have to drink again. I thought that, you know, they'd see it, it's me. You know, say that shit. No, they kept talking to each other. Fuck them. I was even more pissed. They're happy. They're well-dressed. They have friendships. They seem to be content with their lives. They're fucking ignoring me. That was worse than before. So this guy who's sitting up here on the table, like super long hair, it's Derek Dubuque, who now is a good friend of mine. He was maybe 18 months sober then. I thought he was super up. He's just scared. And he's standing up there, ramrod straight, and he bangs a pink can on the table. The room goes dead silent. Dead silent. Fuck. That must be the head of AA right there. I go, I'm going to get to know him after the meeting. So he goes, Janice, Fred, and Bill will read, and Janice, Fred, and Bill read, bang, bang, bang. Dude, he's got the juice card. So Robert C. was the speaker. He was fucking inspirational. Just fucking blew my mind. You know, going, fuck, this AA is pretty cool. You know, this is actually, you know, I can do this. What I thought this was the social aspect. I thought AA was this society that we see, what you see in movies, chairs and cigarettes and issues. So when it came time for announcements, Lord stands up and he says, I'm the coffee maker. If you want to learn how to make insane fucking AA coffee, come see me. If you want to do a searing fourth step, come see me. So I go, fuck, that guy should have come in long before the tat thing. That was a poor sucker. So I figured, I'm going to go check out this guy. The girls seem to like him. So I head over there after the meeting, and I sally up to him, and I say, I'd like you to sponsor me. And he says, please go away now. I said, no, I'm asking you to sponsor me. And he goes, sir, please step away now. Go. And I walked away crestfallen, like, fuck, this is, you know, I knew it. AA sucks. I go back to the Salvation Army, crestfallen. 2 days later, I run into him on Market Street. I say, hey, bro, that wasn't very nice. And he says, what's your name, Lee? You had so much aftershave on, I could not breathe. Any man who comes to a meeting with that much funk on is not coming for recovery. You're coming for pussy. I don't want any part of it. Well, I heard they had teeth. That's why we had gone. He agreed to sponsor, grudgingly. Fuck, here's my number. Fuck. Really grudgingly agreed to sponsor me. And I'm thinking, this sucks. But I went to his house the next week, and my life began to change at a rapid, rapid pace. In any other situation I had been in, it's called cognitive therapy. I was in therapy most of my life. And there's a therapist asking, what did you do? How did it make you feel? Let's consider this. All cognitive shit. Stuff you can see above the waterline and talk about. And I was an expert in fooling therapists. And I thought, here's another therapist. I'm an expert at fooling this guy. And I thought, I'm good at this. But when a sponsor and a sponsee work, it is a vastly different situation. And the other time, the employee assistance counselor is the well person. I'm the sick person. My wife is the well person. I'm the identified problem. Her lawyer's the well person. I'm the whatever. In any other situation, for folks like us, we're the fucked up one, and there's somebody better telling us what we need to do. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two people with the same disease, with the same solution. One has done the work. He's going to explain how he did the work to another. Simply reports of actions taken. And within 2 or 3 minutes, Lord had completely disarmed me, like I was such a quivering jelly. He said, dude, you're in a bunch of pain. You're a know-it-all. Nobody wants to talk to you. Nobody wants to be around you. You're an embarrassment. He'd asked me something about the steps, and I thought he wanted me to do an oration about, you know, the origin of the steps. And he just said, you know, friend, I'm going to ask you not to speak here for the first couple of weeks. But he, in the most loving and energetic and exciting way, took me through the steps with love, with exuberance. We began to laugh. I began to see who I was before. I began to understand what the steps were. The steps are experiences. They are not some pledge that you take. I thought it was a pledge. You took 90 times in 90 days, you were well. He showed me that they're exercises. I began to do the steps. And as I did each step, my life began to improve. When I got to the fourth step, he helped me with it greatly. We now call it like a Mission Street four step. There's a whole style the way it's done in the mission in San Francisco. Basically came from Lord, which you do your four step with your sponsor, because your sponsor has a far better knack of what your part in it is. I said, my wife refused to have sex with me. I'm not going to let go of that resentment. And you say, well, might I ask, did you mention that you're a fucking hopeless heroin addict, you didn't bathe, and you were knotted out the whole time? Might that affect her libido? That, I would never would have thought of that on my own. So what I realized the fourth step was, it's like looking at the list of ingredients. Like you buy a thing of chili, go, oh, 43% tomato paste. Ah, 16% sugar, bad. You know, a fourth step was in my own writing and my own narrative to explore my morals, a fearless moral inventory. What were my real rules of the road? Not what I claimed in front of a therapist, but when I really was under fire, what did I do? And I realized I was full of fear, I was screwed up. The best I could hope to do was con somebody into liking me. And I went through the steps of the Lord, and my life began to change wonderfully. After the seventh step, I wanted to lodge a complaint with the Lord. And I said, I have a formal complaint here. Oh, please sit down. And I said, you know, nobody's really coming up to me at meetings and giving me fellowship. And especially these sponsees should be doing fellowship with me. He goes, what the fuck are you talking about? And I said, well, at least, you know, we have the same sponsor. We're brother sponsees. They should at least, you know, bring me into the fellowship for the meeting. And he goes, okay, Lee, we need to have the talk. The purpose of the 12 steps isn't to make you popular. It's not a Dale Carnegie course. This is to make you whole and useful to God and your fellows. If you want to feel a part of meetings, you need to be a part of meetings. You need to go to meetings to see who you can help, not how popular you think you are. And then he goes, I think our work together is concluded. You're too selfish. Our work is concluded. And he stands up and he opens the door and says, you know, we're done working together. I said, Lord, I know there's something I'm missing, but I don't get it. And he said, you know, Lee, the way that we change from dying to living is to get off your deathbed and help the man next to you. Stop obsessing on what's happening to you, because you'll never figure it out, and begin to see how you can help the man next to you. That is the springboard to becoming happy. I began to try that. Turns out he was right. So I did the steps to the best of my ability. I began sponsoring guys, which was fascinating. I didn't really do amends too well. I didn't do amends very well. Sent a postcard to the boss that had me scribble a resignation. I sent a postcard to him, doing well, got a great girlfriend. That was my amends to him. My dad, who I hadn't talked to in 3 years because he accused me of being drunk on the phone, and I was. I hung up on him. How dare he say that? I was calling for money drunk. I sent him a postcard, doing better now. That was my amends to my dad. It's all I was capable of. Truly, I did not, that's all I could transmit. But after working the steps with sponsees, actually seeing how other sponsees engaged the solution, I did this real amends to people. And it's been the most valuable thing in my life. So I've done the steps. I've made amends to the best of my ability. I sponsor guys. This program has given me a relationship with God, which is the opposite of a relationship with my thoughts. It's the most compassionate thing that's ever happened to me. So I'll close with this thing I always talk about. My first job when I got sober, my boss was Big Book Bill. And he was into the Big Book. And he seemed to demonstrate AA. In the mission, a lot of people discuss AA, but you don't see it demonstrated a lot. But he's my boss, and he just was different. He was different. He was zenned out through the steps. And I said, Bill, everyone talks about, you know, these gratitude lists. I never do a gratitude list. What the fuck? Why do you? He goes, Lee, people make lists of what they like as opposed to what they're thankful for. Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Had no idea what he meant, but I wanted Big Book Bill to think, you know, as a peer. So I said, of course. About a year later, I went to buy this dictionary at a rummage sale. I wanted 50 cents for it because I collect dictionaries. So I'll look up a word, and I'll see if I like the definition. I'll pay the 50 cents. It said gratitude, recognition of comfort given or discomfort taken away. And then I understood what Bill was talking about. Alcoholics Anonymous, I recognize, has provided me a comfort I was unable to give myself through my thoughts. It has taken away from me an allergy and an obsession that I nor none of you could take away. It's the most humane thing that's ever happened to me. So thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.